Side 6, Cradle, by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Continuing on page 143. The lights flashed off and on for several seconds. Charlotte Tiffany slid off of Winters and lay beside him on the bed. He could hear her labored breathing. A voice was heard.
Charlotte?
Then again, with a loud knock on the door.
Charlotte, I know you're in there.
The door sprang open. The two lovers half sat up in bed. The lights went off and the curtain came down. The applause was loud and sustained. Commander Vernon Winters pushed open the door and stumbled outside. He was at the alley entrance to the theater. The door, over which was a single light bulb covered with insects, opened onto a small wooden platform a few steps above the pavement. Winters walked down the three steps and stood beside the red brick wall of the theater. He pulled out a cigarette and lit it. He watched the smoke curl upward against the red brick. In the distance, there was a burst of lightning, then a pause before the sound of rolling thunder. He inhaled deeply again and tried to understand what he had been feeling during those 5 or 10 seconds with Tiffany. I wonder if they could tell, he thought. I wonder if it was obvious to everyone. When he had changed clothes for the first full act of the play, he had noticed the telltale tracks on his undershorts. He expelled some more smoke and winced. And that little girl, my God, she knows for sure. She must have felt it when she was on top of me. Despite himself, he recaptured for an instant his excitement when Tiffany had pressed herself against him. His breath shortened. A first tinge of guilt began to manifest itself. My God, he thought again. What am I? I'm a dirty old man. For some reason, he found himself thinking of Joanna Carr, of a night almost 25 years ago. He remembered the moment when he took her.
Commander,
he heard a voice say. He turned around. Tiffany was standing on the platform in her t-shirt and jeans, her long hair down over her shoulders. Now she was walking down the steps toward him.
Commander,
she said again with a mysterious smile.
May I have a cigarette?
He was dumbfounded, stupefied. He said nothing. Winters automatically reached into his pocket and pulled out his pack of Pall Mells. The girl took one, packed it against her fingernail, and slid it into her mouth. She waited a second, maybe two. Then she gave him another smile. Winters at last woke up and produced his cheap supermarket lighter. She cupped his trembling hand and inhaled vigorously on the cigarette. Winters watched her, fascinated, as she pulled the smoke into her lungs. He studied her mouth, her white neck, her uplifted chest as she caressed the smoke. With the same rapt attention, he watched her diaphragm subside and the smoke curl out of her pursed lips. They stood there together, quietly smoking, neither speaking. Over the ocean, there was another flash of lightning, another roll of thunder. Each time that Tiffany would put the cigarette in her mouth, the mesmerized Winters would follow her every move. She would inhale deeply, intently, pulling hard on the cigarette for the nicotine her body cherished. He was only vaguely aware of his jumbled thoughts. She's beautiful, so beautiful, young and fresh and full of life. And that hair, how I would love to wrap it around my neck. But she's not a little girl. She's a young woman. She must sense what I'm feeling, my fascination for her. She smokes as I do. With complete concentration, she caresses.
I love stormy nights.
Tiffany broke the silence as still another distant flash of lightning lit up the sky. She moved closer to him and then craned her neck to see around a group of trees that was blocking her view of the cloud formation where the lightning was occurring. She brushed against Commander Winters ever so slightly. He was electrified. His mouth was dry. His body was suffused with desire, a desire he barely recognized. He could not answer her comment. Instead, he stared off at the growing storm and took the final drag from his cigarette. She too finished her cigarette and dropped it on the pavement. As she turned to face him and their eyes met, the last wisps of smoke were playfully wandering across her lips. She gave a quick, flirtatious blow with her mouth, and Winters felt a burst of lust in his groin. He retained his self-control, and they entered the theater in silence. The applause continued. Commander Winters brought the women who had played Maxine and Hannah, one on either side of him, forward for their final bow, just as they had planned before the performance began. The applause intensified. Again he stared at the empty seats where Betty and Hap had been before the intermission. He heard a voice from the audience shout, "Charlotte Goodall!" and Winters improvised. He took the two ladies back to the line of the assembled cast and walked down the line to Tiffany. For a moment, she did not understand. Then her face broke into a radiant smile, and she took his hand. He walked forward with her to the front of the stage, their hands wrapped together in a tight hold. This was her special moment. She was near tears as she heard the applause grow again. He stood aside, and she bowed gracefully to the audience. She finished her bow, took his hand again with a delightful squeeze, and backed up into the line with the cast. Melvin, Mark, and Amanda were all backstage while they were dressing. Enthusiastic congratulations were everywhere. Melvin particularly seemed ecstatic. He admitted that he had had some misgivings during rehearsals, but that everyone had been wonderful. The director confided to Winters that the bedroom scene with Tiffany had been superb, couldn't have been better, as Melvin literally danced out the dressing room door. Winters was overwhelmed with a myriad of emotions. He was pleased with his performance in the play and the audience reception, but other more personal things were on his mind. What had happened to Betty and Hap? Why had they left at intermission? In his mind's eye, Winters imagined Betty watching his love scene with Tiffany. He had a momentary panic as he convinced himself that she had known from out in the audience that her husband was not acting at all, that he was every bit as aroused as the character he was playing. What had occurred with Tiffany, he could not begin to understand and could not even think about without starting to feel guilty. While he was putting back on his Navy uniform, he allowed himself to taste again her kisses on the bed in the play and to feel the sexual tension while they smoked together in the alley. But beyond his awareness of his arousal, he would not go. Guilt was a depressing emotion, and on his successful opening night, he did not want to be depressed. When Commander Winters walked out of the men's communal dressing room, Tiffany was waiting for him. Her hair was back in pigtails, her face scrubbed free of makeup. She looked again like a little girl. "Commander," she said, almost with servility, "would you do me a favor, please?" He smiled his assent. She beckoned to him, and he followed her out in the hall that was adjacent to the backstage quarters. A red-haired man about the commander's age was standing in the hall, nervously smoking a cigarette and pacing. It was obvious that he felt uncomfortable and out of place. Next to him was a tawdry brunette, early 30s perhaps, chewing gum and talking to the man in a whisper. The man noticeably relaxed when he saw the commander in his uniform.
"Well, sir," he said to Winters when Tiffany introduced him as her father, "it's good to meet you. I don't know much about this acting business, but I worry that it's unhealthy for my daughter sometimes." He winked at his wife, Tiffany's stepmother, and lowered his voice. "You know, sir, with all the wimps and fags and other weirdo actors, a man can't be too careful. But Tiff told me there was a real Navy officer, a bona fide commander, as part of the cast. At first, I didn't believe her." Mr. Thomas was definitely getting signals both from Tiffany and his wife. He was talking too much. "I'm regular Navy myself," he blurted out as Winters remained silent. "Almost 25 years. Signed up when I was just a boy of 18. Met Tiff's mother 2 years later."
"Daddy," Tiffany interrupted him, "you promised that you wouldn't embarrass me. Please just ask him. He probably has things that he needs to do."
The commander had certainly not been prepared to meet Tiffany's father and stepmother. In fact, he had never for a moment even thought about her parents, although as he stood there listening to Mr. Thomas, it all made sense. Tiffany was, after all, only a junior in high school. "So, of course, she lives at home," he thought. "With her parents." Mr. Thomas was looking very serious. For about a second, Winters felt fear and the beginning of panic.
"No. No," he thought quickly. "She can't have told them anything. It's all much too soon."
"My wife and I play bridge," Mr. Thomas was saying. "Duplicate bridge in tournaments. and this weekend there's a big sectional in Miami. We'll be leaving tomorrow morning and coming back very late on Sunday night." Winters was puzzled. He was lost in this conversation. Why should he care about what the Thomases did with their free time? At length, Mr. Thomas came to the point. "So we had called May's cousin and Marathon and asked her if she would pick my daughter up after the show tomorrow night. But that would mean Tiff would have to miss the cast party. Tiff suggested that maybe you would be willing to see her home safely from the party and..." Mr. Thomas smiled pleasantly. "Keep a fatherly eye on her while I'm off playing bridge." Winters instinctively glanced at Tiffany. For just a few milliseconds, he saw a worldly look in her eyes that tore through him like a fireball. Then she was a little girl again, entreating her father to let her go to the party. The commander played his role well. "All right, Mr. Thomas," he replied. "I'll be glad to help out." He patted Tiffany fondly. "She deserves to go to the party. She's worked hard." He paused for a moment. "But I have a couple of questions. There will certainly be champagne at the party, and it will probably go real late. Does she have a curfew? How do you feel about..." "Just use your own judgment, Commander," Mr. Thomas cut him short. "May and I trust you completely." The man reached over and shook Winter's hand. "And thank you very much. By the way," he added as he turned around to leave, "you were great, although I must admit I was worried when you were necking with my daughter. The fag that wrote the play must have been one weird dude." Tiffany's stepmother mumbled thanks over her chewing gum, and the girl herself said, "See you tomorrow," as the three of them walked away. The commander reached in his pocket for another cigarette. Betty and Hap were both asleep, as Commander Winters knew they would be when he finally arrived home around 11 o'clock. He walked softly past his son's room, but then stopped outside of Betty's. Basically a considerate man, Winters spent a few seconds weighing Betty's sleep against his need for an explanation. He decided to go in and wake her up. He was surprised to find that he was nervous when he sat down on the side of her bed in the dark. She was sleeping on her back with a sheet and a very thin blanket both pulled up neatly to within about 2 inches of her shoulders. He shook her lightly. "Betty, dear," he said, "I'm home. I'd like to talk to you." She stirred. He shook her again. "It's burning," he said softly. His wife sat up in bed and turned on the light on the end table. Underneath the light was a small picture of the face of Jesus, a man wise beyond his 30 or so years, with a full beard, a serious look, and a glow approximating a halo behind his head. "Goodness," she said, frowning and rubbing her eyes. "What's going on? Is everything all right?" Betty had never been particularly pretty. But in the last 10 years, she had ignored her looks altogether, and had even put on 20 pounds of ungainly weight. "Yes," he answered. "I just wanted to talk. And to find out why you and Hap left the show just after the intermission." Betty looked him directly in the eyes. This was a woman without guile, even without nuance. Life was simple and straightforward for her. If you truly believed in God and Jesus Christ, then you had no doubts about anything. "Vernon," she began, "I have often wondered why you choose to perform in such strange plays. But I have never complained about it, particularly since it seems to be the only thing that has excited you in a good way since Libya and that awful beach incident." She frowned, and a cloud seemed to cross her face momentarily. Then she continued in her matter-of-fact way. "But Hap is no longer a child. He is becoming a young man, and hearing his father, even in a play, refer to God as a petulant old man and a senile delinquent is not likely to strengthen his faith." She looked away. "And I thought it was equally disturbing for him to watch you groping with that young girl. All in all," she said, glancing back at her husband and summarizing the entire issue, "I thought the play had no values, no morals, and nothing worth staying for." Winters felt his anger building, but struggled with it as he always did. He envied Betty her steadfast faith, her ability to see God clearly in every daily activity. He himself felt disjoint from the God of his childhood, and his fruitless personal searches had not yet resulted in a clearer perception of him. But a couple of things Winters did know for certain. His God would laugh with and have compassion for Tennessee Williams' characters, and he would not be pleased by bombs falling on little children. The commander did not argue with Betty. He gave her a brotherly kiss on the cheek, and she turned off the light. For just a moment, he wondered, how long has it been? 3 weeks? But he couldn't remember the exact time, or even whether or not it had been good. They fooled around, as Betty called it, whenever her awareness of his need overcame her general lack of interest. Probably about normal for couples our age, Winters thought, somewhat defensively as he undressed in his room. But he was not able to sleep as he lay quietly in the dark underneath the sheet. The feeling of arousal that had been so intense first during the play and then again out in the alley continued to call to him. With pictures. When he closed his eyes, he could again see Tiffany's soft and flirtatious lips blowing out the last of the smoke that had been deep within her lungs. His mouth could still taste those passionate kisses that she had forced upon him during the bedroom scene. And then there was that special look when her father had asked him to take care of her at the party. Had he imagined it? Several times Commander Winters changed positions in his bed, trying to dispel the images in his mind and the nervousness that was keeping him awake. He was unsuccessful. Eventually, while he was lying on his back, he realized there was one possible release from this kind of tension. At first he felt guilty, even embarrassed, but the waves of images of Tiffany continued to flood into his brain. He touched himself. The images from the day sharpened and began to expand into fantasies. She was lying on top of him on the bed, as she had been in the play, and he was responding to her kisses. For a brief second, Winters became frightened and held himself in check. But a desperate surge of longing removed his last inhibition. He was again an adolescent, alone in his rich imagination. The scene in his mind changed. He was lying naked on a huge king-size bed in an opulent room with high ceilings. Tiffany approached him from the lighted bathroom, also naked, her long auburn hair cascading over her shoulders and hiding the nipples of her breasts. She took a last languorous pull from her cigarette and put it out in the ashtray beside the bed, her eyes never leaving his as she slowly, almost lovingly, expelled the last of the smoke from her mouth. She climbed into the bed beside him. He could feel the softness of her skin, the tingle of her long hair against his neck and chest. She kissed him gently but passionately, with her hands behind his head. He felt her tongue playing enticingly across his lips. She moved her body into position next to him and pressed her pelvis into his. He felt himself rising. She took his penis in her hand and squeezed lightly. He was completely erect. She squeezed again, then gracefully raised her body up and inserted him deep inside her. He felt a magical, moist warmth and then exploded almost immediately. Commander Winters was staggered by the power and the intensity of his fantasy. Somewhere inside him, a voice cried for caution and warned of dire consequences if he let this fantasy become too real. But as he lay spent and alone in his suburban home, he pushed his guilt and fears aside and allowed himself the unrivaled bliss of post-orgasmic sleep. 9. Sloppy Joe's was an institution in Key West. The favorite bar of Hemingway and his motley crew had managed to adapt quickly to the multifaceted evolution of the city that it had come to symbolize. Many denizens of the old city had been almost apoplectic when the bar had forsaken its historic location downtown and moved into the vast shopping complex surrounding the new marina. But even they grudgingly admitted, after the club reopened in a well-ventilated large room complete with sound stage and excellent acoustics, that the Tiffany lamps, long wooden bars, narrow mirrors from ceiling to floor, and memorabilia from 100 years in Key West had been tastefully rearranged in a way that retained the spirit of the old bar. It was altogether fitting that Angie Leatherwood should perform as the headliner at Sloppy Joe's during her brief and infrequent returns to the city of her birth. Troy's glib tongue had originally talked the owner, a transplanted 50-year-old New Yorker named Tony Palazzo, into giving her an audition when she was still 19. Tony had heard her sing for 5 minutes and then had exclaimed, punctuating his comments with wild hand gestures, "It's not enough that you bring me a black girl who's so beautiful she takes your breath away. No, you bring me one who also sings like a nightingale. Mamma mia, life is not fair. My daughter Carla would kill to sound like that." Tony had become Angie's biggest fan and had unselfishly promoted her career. Angie never forgot what Tony had done for her and always sang at Sloppy Joe's when she was in town. She was like that. Troy's table was front and center, about 10 feet away from the edge of the stage. Nick and Troy were already seated at the small round table and had finished their first drinks when Carol arrived about 5 minutes before 10:30. She apologized and mumbled something about parking in Siberia. As soon as she arrived, Nick pulled out the envelope of images, and both men told her that they had found the pictures fascinating. Nick began asking questions about the photographs while Troy summoned a waiter. Nick and Carol were involved in an earnest conversation about the objects in the fissure when the new drinks reached the table. Nick had just mentioned that one of them looked like a modern missile. It was 10:35. The lights flashed off and on to announce that the show was beginning. Angie Leatherwood was a consummate performer. Like many of the very best entertainers, she never forgot that it was the audience that was the customer, that it was they who both created her image and enhanced her mystique. She began with the title song from her new album, Memories of Enchanting Nights, and then sang a medley of Whitney Houston songs, according a tribute to that brilliant songstress whose talent had sparked Angie's own desire to sing. Next, she showed her versatility by blending a quartet of songs with different beats, a Jamaican reggae, a soft ballad from her first album, Love Letters, a nearly perfect Diana Ross imitation from an old Supreme song, Where Did Our Love Go?, and an emotionally powerful lilting encomium to her blind father entitled The Man with Vision. Thunderous applause greeted the conclusion of each song. Sloppy Joe's was sold out, including all the standing room along the 100-foot bar. 7 different huge video screens scattered throughout the spacious club brought Angie home to those who were not close to the stage. This was her crowd. These were her friends. A couple of times, Angie was almost embarrassed because the clapping and the bravos would not stop. At Troy's table, very little was said during the show. The threesome pointed out songs they particularly liked. Carol's favorite was the Whitney Houston song, The Greatest Love of All. But there was no time for conversation. Angie dedicated her penultimate song, Let Me Take Care of You, Baby, to her dearest friend. Nick kicked Troy under the table, and then finished with her most popular cut from Love Letters. The audience gave her a standing ovation and hooted noisily for an encore. Nick noticed while he was standing that he was a little woozy from the 2 strong drinks and was also feeling strangely emotional, possibly because of the subliminal associations created by the love songs that Angie was singing. Angie returned to the stage. As the noise subsided, her soft and caressing voice could be heard. "You all know that Key West is a very special place for me. It was here that I was raised and went to school. Most of my memories bring me back here." She paused and her eyes scanned the audience. "There are many songs that bring back memories and the emotions that go with them. But of all of them, my favorite is the theme song from the musical Cats. So Key West, this is for you." There was scattered clapping as the music synthesizers accompanying her played the introduction to Memories. The audience remained standing as Angie's mellifluous voice launched into the beautiful song. As soon as she began, Nick was instantly transported to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. in June of 1984, where he was watching a production of Cats with his mother and father. He had finally come home to explain to them why he had been unable to return to Harvard after his spring break in Florida. But try as he might, he could not begin to tell the story to his disappointed father and broken-hearted mother. All he could say was, "It was a woman," and then he would fall silent. It had been a sad reunion. While he was visiting his home in Falls Church, the first malignant polyps had been discovered and removed from his father's colon. The doctors had been optimistic about several more years of life, but they had stressed that colon cancer often recurred and metastasized to other parts of the body. and a long talk with his suddenly frail father, Nick had promised to finish his degree in Miami. But that was little solace to the older man. He had dreamed of seeing his son graduate from Harvard. The performance of Cats at the Kennedy Center had been only mildly entertaining for Nick. In the middle, he had found himself wondering how many people in the audience really knew the author of the source material for the songs, this poet T.S. Eliot, who not only admired and enjoyed feline idiosyncrasies, but also once began a poem by describing the evening spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. But when the old female cat walked to center stage, her beauty faded into wrinkles and began her song of her days in the sun, Nick had been moved right along with the entire audience. For reasons he never understood, he had seen Monique singing the song years in the future. And in Washington, he had wept, silent tears, hidden quickly from his parents, when the achingly pure soprano voice had reached the climax of the song. Touch me. It's so easy to leave me, all alone with my memories of my days in the sun. If you touch me, you'll understand what happiness is. Angie's voice at Sloppy Joe's was not nearly as piercing as that soprano in Washington, but she sang with the same intensity, evoking all the sadness of someone for whom all the joys of life are in the past. The corners of Nick's eyes filled with tears, and one of them brimmed out to run down his cheek. From where Carol was standing, the lights from the stage reflected off Nick's cheek. She saw the tear, the window of vulnerability, and was herself moved in return. For the first time, she felt a deep stirring, almost an affection for this distant, solitary, but strangely attractive man. Ah, Carol, how different it might have been if, for once in your life, you had not acted impulsively. If you had just let the man have his moment of loneliness or heartbreak or tenderness or whatever he was feeling, then you might have mentioned it later at a quieter time to some advantage. The sharing of this moment might even have eventually been part of the bonding between you. But you had to tap Nick on the shoulder before the song was through, before he even realized himself that he was tearful, and break his precious communion with his inner self. You were an interloper. Worse, as so often happens, he interpreted your smile as derision, not sympathy, and like a frightened turtle, withdrew completely from the evening. It was guaranteed that he would reject as insincere any subsequent overtures of friendship. Troy missed the interplay between Carol and Nick, so he was quite surprised when he turned around and sat down after the final applause to find Nick's shoulders set in an unmistakable pose of hostility. "Wasn't she wonderful, Angel?" Troy said to Carol. "And how about you, Professor? Was this the first time you heard her sing?" Nick nodded. "She was great," he said almost grudgingly. "And I am thirsty. Can a man get a drink in this place?" Troy was slightly offended. "Well, pardon us," he said. "So sorry that the entertainment lasted so long." He tried to signal for the waiter. "What's eating him, Angel?" he said conversationally to Carol. Carol shrugged her shoulders. Then, trying to lighten the atmosphere, she leaned toward Nick and tapped him on the forearm on top of the table. "Hey, Nick," she said, "have you been taking angry pills?" Nick quickly withdrew his arm and grumbled something inaudible as a reply. He turned away from the conversation and saw that Angie was approaching the table. He stood up automatically, and both Carol and Troy joined him. "You were fantastic," said Carol, a little too loud, just as soon as Angie was within earshot. "Thanks. Hi," replied Angie, as she walked up to the table and took the chair that Troy had pulled out for her. She spent a few moments graciously acknowledging the praise from people at the nearby tables. Then she sat down and smiled. "You must be Carol Dawson," she said easily, leaning across the table toward the reporter. Angie was even more beautiful in person than she had been in the picture on the disc jacket. Her coloring was a dark brown, not quite black. Her makeup, including the light pink lipstick, was muted to permit her natural assets, including virtually perfect white teeth on prominent display when she smiled, to draw the attention. But beyond the beauty was the woman herself. No still photograph could do justice to the natural warmth that radiated from Angie. You liked her immediately. "And you must be Nick Williams," Angie said, extending her hand to Nick. He was still standing, looking uncomfortable and uncertain, although Troy had already seated himself. "Troy has told me so many things about you in the past few days, I feel as if we're already friends. He claims that you've read every novel ever written that's worth reading."
"That's an exaggeration, of course," Nick replied, obviously pleased to be recognized. He seemed to loosen up a little and finally sat down. He started to add another comment, but Carol jumped into the conversation and cut him off.
"Did you write that beautiful song about the blind man yourself?" she asked, before Angie had really had time to sit down and collect herself. "It seemed to be a very personal statement."
"Yes," Angie answered Carol pleasantly, without a trace of irritation at Carol's aggressive behavior.
"Most of my material comes from other sources, but occasionally I write a song myself, when it is a very special subject for me."
She smiled briefly at Troy before continuing.
"My father is a remarkable, loving man, blind from birth, but with an uncanny comprehension of the world at all levels. Without his patience and guidance, I probably would never have had the courage to sing as a little girl. I was too shy and self-conscious. But my father convinced all of us, when we were small, that we were somehow special. He told us that God had given each of us something unusual, something uniquely ours, and that one of the great joys of life was discovering and then developing that special talent."
"And that song, Let Me Take Care of You, Baby, did you really write that for Troy?" Nick blurted out his question before Angie had finished her sentence. He thereby destroyed the soft mood created by Angie's loving description of her father. Nick was on the edge of his chair and for some reason seemed agitated and unsettled. Troy wondered again what he had missed in the interaction between Carol and Nick that had caused his friend to become so tense. Angie looked at Troy.
"I guess so," she said with a wistful smile, although it was originally meant to be a playful tune, a light commentary on the game of love. She stopped for a moment. "But it does talk about a real problem. It's very hard sometimes being a successful woman. It interferes."
"Amen, amen," Carol interrupted while Angie was still developing her thought. This was one of Carol's favorite subjects, and she was ready to pounce on the opportunity.
"Most men cannot deal with a woman who is the least bit successful, much less in the spotlight." She looked directly at Nick and then continued. "Even now, in 1994, there are still unwritten rules that must be followed. If you want to have a permanent relationship with a man, there are three don'ts. Don't let him think you're smarter than he is, don't suggest sex first, and above all, don't make more money than he does. These are the three key areas where their egos are extremely fragile. And if you undermine the ego of any man, even when you're just kidding with him, then it's a lost cause."
"Sounds like you're an expert," Nick replied sarcastically. His hostility was obvious. "I wonder if it ever occurred to any of you liberated females that men are not put off by your success, but rather by the way you handle it. What you accomplish in life does not mean shit at the personal level. Most ambitious, aggressive women I have met," and now he was looking directly at Carol, "go out of their way to make male-female relationships into some kind of competition. They will not let the man, even for a moment, have the illusion that he lives in a patriarchal society. I think some of them purposely emasculate."
"There it is," Carol jumped in triumphantly. She nudged Angie, who was smiling but still a little embarrassed at the rancor in this exchange. "That's the magic word. Whenever a woman wants to argue and not accept as gospel some profound male truth, she is trying to castrate or emasculate."
"Okay, you guys," Troy interjected firmly, shaking his head. "That's enough. Let's change the subject. I had thought that maybe you two could enjoy an evening together, but not if we're going to start this way."
"The problem," Carol continued, now looking at Angie and ignoring Troy's request, "is that men are frightened. Their hegemony in the Western world is threatened by the emergence of women who aren't willing to be just barefoot and pregnant. Why, when I was at Stanford..."
She stopped and turned when she heard the legs of a chair scraping across the floor. "With all due respect, Miss Leatherwood," Nick was standing up again, holding the chair in his hand, "I believe I will excuse myself. I thoroughly enjoyed your music, but I do not wish to subject you to any more bad manners. I wish you continued good fortune in your career, and I hope that someday you can spend some time on the boat with Troy and me. Nick turned to Troy. I'll see you at the marina at 8 o'clock in the morning. Finally, he looked at Carol. You too, if you still want to go. You can tell us about the wimps at Stanford while we're out in the middle of the Gulf. Nick did not wait for a reply. He picked up the envelope and walked back through the crowd toward the exit. As he was approaching the door, he heard a voice calling him. Nick? Oh, Nick, over here. It was Julianne, waving to him from a nearby table full of glasses and ashtrays. She and Corrine and Linda were surrounded by half a dozen men, but Julianne was moving them all around and pulling up an empty chair. Nick walked over to her table. 30 minutes later, Nick was very drunk. The combination of Julianne's occasionally brushing his leg, Corrine's gigantic breasts, they were covered now, but he could remember them from Troy's game in the afternoon, and intermittent glimpses of Carol through the cigarette smoke had made him very horny as well. God damn it, Williams, he had thought to himself when he first sat down with Julianne's group. You blew it again. Here you had this perfect chance to charm her, maybe even score. But half an hour later, after the drinks, his thoughts were more reminiscent of Aesop's fox. She's too aggressive for me anyway. Famous, pushy, probably too hard underneath, and cold in bed. Another ball buster. Yet still he watched her from across the room. The extra chairs that had been brought in for Angie's performance were cleared away to make room for dancing. A disc jockey orchestrated the rest of the evening from a booth next to the stage. One could dance to a variety of modern musical selections, watch the outrageously overproduced music videos on the big screens, or just talk, for the music was not overwhelmingly loud. Most of the people around Nick were from the marina. During a break in the music, just after Nick had downed another fast tequila, Linda Quinlan leaned across the table. "Come on, Nick," she said. "Let us in on your secret. What did you and Troy find yesterday?" "Nothing special," said Nick, remembering his agreement, but surprised to discover that he did indeed want to talk about it. "Rumor says different," jumped in one of the men at the table. "Everybody knows that you took something to Amanda Winchester this morning. Come on, tell us what it was. Have you found a new treasure ship?" "Maybe," said Nick, a drunken grin on his face. "Just maybe." Another strong impulse pushed him to tell the story and show the pictures, but he stopped himself. "I can't talk about it," was all he would say. At this moment, two burly young men, short-haired Navy types wearing officers' uniforms, were making a beeline for Nick's table from the other side of the floor. One of them was dark as panic. Their approach was confident, even arrogant, and their arrival at the table stopped all the conversation. The white lieutenant put his hand on Julianne's shoulder. "All right, gorgeous," he said boldly. "The Navy is here." "Why don't you and your friend there," he nodded at Corrine. Ramirez was standing behind her. "Come and dance with us." Julianne said, "No, thank you," very politely and smiled. Todd looked down at her. He was weaving just a little, and it was clear from his eyes that he had been drinking heavily. "You mean to tell me," he said, "that you would prefer to sit here with these local geeks rather than dance with future admirals?" Julianne felt his hand tighten on her shoulder. She looked around the table and tried to ignore him. Todd did not like rejection. He took his hand off Julianne's shoulder and pointed at Corrine's breasts. "Christ, Ramirez, you were right. They are monsters. Wouldn't you like to snarf one of those?" The two lieutenants laughed crudely. Corrine squirmed self-consciously. Linda Quinlan's steady boyfriend rose from his chair. Other than Nick, he was the only one of the men at the table who was approximately the same size as Todd and Ramirez. "Look, guys," he said reasonably. "The lady said no very nicely. There is no need to insult her or her friends." "Listen to him, Ramirez," Todd interrupted. "This character said we insulted someone. Since when is admiring the size of someone's cachungas an insult?" He chuckled to himself at his cleverness. Ramirez made a sign to leave, but Todd waved him off. The drunken Nick had been ready to explode all night. "Get out of here, asshole," he said, quietly but firmly. He was still sitting down next to Julianne. Who are you calling asshole, cocksucker? The truculent Lieutenant Todd replied. He turned to Ramirez. I do believe that I'm going to be forced to strum the head of this impertinent bastard. But Nick was ahead of him. Rising swiftly, he uncoiled a vicious punch that struck Todd full in the face and sent him tumbling backwards into another table covered with drinks. Todd and the table crashed to the floor, and Nick went after him. Ramirez pulled Nick off his fellow officer, and when Nick turned and swung at him as well, Ramirez gave Nick a push that caused his unsteady legs to give way. Nick fell back over Julianne, and another full table collapsed upon the floor. From across the room, Carol and Angie and Troy could see the fracas and recognize Nick in the middle of it. Uh-oh, Troy said, jumping up to go to his friend's aid. Carol was right behind him. When they reached the opposite side of the room, both club bouncers were already on top of the action. Meanwhile, Nick and Julianne were still trying to get unscrambled on the floor, and Todd was slowly rising to his feet. In the fight, the envelope of photos had been knocked free, and a couple of them had fallen partially out. Ramirez had picked the envelope up off the floor and, because of the bright colors, was looking at the pictures. The close-up of the brown missile in the fissure was clearly visible in the top photo. Hey, he said to the shaken Todd, look at this. What do you think this is all about? Carol acted instantly. She walked past Ramirez, grabbed the envelope and pictures, and before he could say anything, she screamed, Not again, Nick. No, I don't believe it. How could you be drunk again? She knelt down beside Nick on the floor and cradled his head in her free hand. Oh, darling, she said, as he stared at her in complete disbelief. You promised that you'd stop. The astonished crowd watched as Carol kissed Nick full on the mouth to prevent his saying anything. Troy was amazed. Troy, she shouted a moment later, while Nick was trying to gather his wits. Troy, where are you? Here, give me a hand. Troy rushed up and helped Nick to his feet. We're taking him home now, she announced to the onlookers. She and Troy each took one arm, and the three of them stumbled toward the door of the nightclub. They passed the manager in the doorway. Carol told him that she would come by the next day to settle accounts. She and Troy half carried Nick into the street. As they walked away from Sloppy Joe's, Carol turned around and saw that part of the crowd had followed them to the door. Ramirez and Todd, the latter still rubbing his cheek, were standing in front of the group with puzzled expressions on their faces. Where are we taking him, Angel? Troy asked when they were out of earshot. We don't even know where he parked his car.
It doesn't matter, Carol replied, just as long as we are out of sight of the club.
The awkward threesome turned right down the same alley that ran behind the theater where the night of the iguana had finished an hour before. Just past the theater, there was a small vacant lot on the left. Carol stopped the trio at the edge of the lot, opposite a grove of trees, and looked back to make certain they were not being followed. She heaved a sigh and loosened her grip on Nick. She unconsciously fanned her sweating face with the envelope she had recovered from Ramirez. Nick was now almost coherent. I had no idea, he mumbled to Carol, pulling his arm free from Troy and trying to embrace her. That you felt that way about me.
I don't, Carol said emphatically.
She pushed his arms away and backpedaled toward the vacant lot. Nick didn't understand and continued his approach.
Stop, she shouted angrily at him. Stop, you drunken bastard.
She tried to fend off his advance with her hands, but he kept coming. Just before Troy moved up to restrain him, Carol slapped Nick hard in the face with the hand that was not holding the envelope. Momentarily startled, Nick lost his footing and fell into the grass on his stomach. Still fuming, Carol bent down beside him and forcefully rolled him over on his back.
Don't you ever, ever use physical force with me, she shouted at Nick. Not under any circumstances.
She dropped the envelope on Nick's stomach and stood up quickly. She looked at Troy, shook her head in disgust, and stalked off down the alley. Assembly and test. Under the scanning electron microscope, they look like tightly coiled springs with a small tail. When they are placed in water or some other liquid, the springs seem to stretch out and cilia-like appendages extend a few angstroms out from the tail to provide motility. There are millions of them concentrated in a mixture the size of a tiny drop of water, and they are being carefully checked by a laser device that is also counting and sorting them as it illuminates microscopic portions of the mixture.
When the count is completed, the smaller division of the separated mixture is sluiced out of the metal receptacle and down a channel into another liquid, this one emerald green in color, that is contained in a bottle-shaped beaker. The springs spread out and follow random paths in wandering around the beaker. External mechanisms regularly churn the emerald green liquid. Around the inside of the beaker, tiny sensors register the temperature, pressure, and exact chemical and electrical characteristics of the fluid. Some parameter is not absolutely perfect. A small valve opens a port in the base of the beaker, and a new chemical is injected into the green solution. Continuous measurements monitor the diffusion of this additional material. At length, the fluid is properly altered, and a new equilibrium is reached. Everything is now ready. From above, several thousand small pellets are dropped into the container. Some of these pellets float on the surface, but most sink to variable depths in the liquid. Embedded in each of the pellets is a complicated engineering construction on an amazingly miniaturized scale. The external surface of the pellets contains sensors that scan the nearby region of the liquid for the spring-like objects. A high-frequency transmitter housed next to the sensors directs a call to the springs and attracts them to the neighborhood. Clusters of springs develop around each pellet. Now, one at a time, these springs are harvested by small instruments inside the spongy outer section of the pellet and then loaded in carriers that are electrically fired toward the central cavity of the pellet. Within that cavity sits a single black amorphous spot, its exterior constantly changing shape as its opaque material shifts around to follow unknown stimuli. This spot is surrounded by a yellow goo that fills the remainder of the cavity. The first spring slips out of its carrier, then locates and penetrates the spot. The spring can be seen for an instant moving toward the center. However, it is broken up and destroyed within milliseconds. Other springs are fired into the cavity at regular intervals and all try, after penetration, to reach some special region in the spot. Finally, one of the processions succeeds and the spot changes color to bright red. In rapid succession, some enzyme in the spongy outer section of the pellet is dumped into the yellow goo, turning its color a little toward green, and all the rest of the springs disappear, apparently absorbed by the pellet structure. The entire pellet itself next elongates and extends a miniature propulsion system into the emerald liquid. After carefully steering around the many hazards, it then joins the queue of fertilized pellets moving one by one through a round diaphanous membrane in the bottom of the beaker. The fluid, dense with pellets, speeds along a narrow tube until it reaches a partially closed container approximately the size of the beaker. Inside this translucent jar, a mechanical, spoon-like object digs into the stream of liquid flowing through and plucks out the pellets. They are lifted up and then suspended momentarily around the passing fluid in a heavy gas enclosed by the jar. Within moments, each of the pellets splits, and their carapaces apparently dissolve, leaving visible inside the jar an array of the little red spots surrounded by the off-yellow goo and suspended in an invisible gas. The goo extends itself slowly throughout the jar above the flowing fluid until all the open areas between the red spots are filled. When the emerald stream below drops to a trickle and then disappears altogether, the goo hardens into a gelatin and fills the ports where the fluid once entered and departed. Within the jar are several thousand red spots embedded in the yellow-green gelatin. The spots undergo no visible change throughout this process. Time passes. Activity in the jar ceases. Occasionally, mechanical probes to test the stability of the gelatin are inserted into the jar at the old fluid ports. At last, the translucent jar is removed from its storage location by what looks like a robotic forklift. It is placed on a moving belt that now carries it along with several dozen other jars containing different kinds of objects. Blue pencils, purple stars, and red boxes can all be seen. Also suspended in yellow-green gelatin to a vast circular oven almost an inch in diameter. Here all the jars are carefully baked together. Inside the oven, the molecules of the jar material immediately evaporate.
next a pair of disembodied manipulator hands wrap an incredibly thin blanket of connective filaments around all the gelatinous structures. After some time, this ensemble unit is then pulled automatically out of the oven and packaged inside a gold metallic envelope whose several layers are designed to provide all the remaining environmental protection. The hypergolic propellants mix and burst instantly into flame, pouring fire out the rocket nozzle. The slender vehicle rises, slowly at first, but later with astonishing speed. Before reaching the zenith of its flight, the rocket stage underneath the strange paraboloid payload falls away, and tiny motors ignite on the underside of the flying boomerang. At the apex of the trajectory, the entire package suddenly explodes and apparently disintegrates. Hundreds of pieces of the original payload fall toward the surface of the planet in seemingly random directions. Closer inspection reveals that each individual piece resulting from the explosion is made of a gold metallic material encased in plastic. A small sensor propulsion package is attached to the plastic. It supplies needed vernier corrections during the descent after the controlled explosion. The plastic debris falls upon a strange hybrid planet, obviously artificial, judging by the wide variety of incongruous surfaces and cloud groupings that can be recognized from an altitude of tens of miles. There are scattered liquid lakes of different hues, plus discontinuous surface topography with regions of desert and grasslands, as well as barren mountains and canyons. A connected quarter of the planet is covered with clouds. The clouds are here white and fleecy, there brown and thick. Some of the clouds are active, building and changing with hints of turbulence. Other parts of the cloudy region are static, small wisps of white stretching without change across the sky. One of the plastic vehicles plunges through a misty blue cloud bank into an emerald sea. The plastic is left on the surface, but the encased gold metallic object sinks 30 feet to the floor of the ocean. For a day or two, there is no discernible change in its appearance. Then a protrusion begins to form in its north polar region, on the top of the golden sphere as it sits on the ocean floor. The growth expands slowly until the spherical shape appears to have a large carbuncle on its top. A metamorphosis now takes place. On the outside of the protrusion, the hard metal surface softens and begins to resemble an organic membrane. Although the membrane is thick and dense, it occasionally bulges, suggesting some motion on the other side of its golden barrier. Eventually, a thin black rod, a probe of some kind, thrusts through the surface into the emerald ocean. A second probe becomes visible, then a third. Both long black rods like the first one, but each equipped with strikingly different apparatus scattered along the length of the rod. Something larger pushes against the membrane, once, twice, then finally breaking through. But a strange contraption. It's an aerodynamic shape about 3 inches long, in two separate segments with a joint between them. The forebody is a nose cone. The afterbody is long and slender and tapers to a point. In addition to the three probes on the front of its forebody, it has four other furlable appendages or arms, two connected to the side of each segment. It swims over to a nearby underwater plant with its arms stored next to its smooth body. There it unfurls the multifaceted appendages and begins to examine the plant. An astonishing array of tiny instruments studies the plant for a few moments, and then the entity moves away. The same procedure is repeated with each plant encountered. Eventually, the thing finds a plant that it likes, and its pincers remove a major leaf. The leaf is neatly folded into a smaller volume and is then carried back to the object with the golden membrane. The strange forager is joined by a partner, a carbon copy of itself, and by two fat fish with multiple arms and legs. The latter pair scuttle off to the side and begin modifying the ocean floor. Days pass. The things with the probes work ceaselessly, bringing more and more varieties of plant and animal life back to the home base. The legged fish, meanwhile, have constructed, out of available sand, rocks, shells, and living creatures, almost 1,000 tiny sealed rectangular homes on the ocean floor. These fish entities, too, work without break. Their next task is to transport each of the red spots, one at a time, from the golden cradle to their new houses. If a microscope were available, it would show that some structure was already developing inside the red spots, giving them definition and distinction by the time of their initial transport. But they are still very, very small. Once the red spots and their gelatin protection are carefully implanted inside their tiny houses, the foragers make routine stops on each trip to deposit a portion of their harvest. At the same time, the fish with legs, the architects and builders of the rectangular houses, begin working on transparent igloo-like homes for the embryos of another species. A year later, moonlight falls on the Emerald Lake. Several hundred eager, excited, wriggling necks, some royal blue and some pale blue, struggle upward to find the moon. Their heads pivot to face all directions, and maybe two dozen separate indentations and orifices can be seen in each face. The necks crane this way, then that way. The silent serpents are searching for something. From the direction of the moon, a bizarre ship approaches on the water. It is large compared to the young serpents, its twin towers standing about 8 feet out of the water and about 6 feet above, on the average, a squarish platform 15 feet on a side that forms the bottom of the boat. The top surface of this platform is irregular, undulating, and cratered. The platform floats smoothly upon the water. The ship comes into the middle of the serpents and stops. The serpents divide into two groups according to the color of their necks, and then line up on either side of the ship in very orderly rows and columns. A single musical note, a B-flat with a flautish timbre, comes from the ship. Quickly the note is repeated up and down the rows and columns by each of the serpents on the two sides of the boat. Then a second note issues forth from the ship, also sounding like a flute, and the process repeats itself. For hours, the music lesson continues, covering a range of both notes and chords, until some of the serpents on each side lose their voices. The exercise concludes with an attempted ensemble performance by the royal blue-necked serpents, but the result is a painful cacophony. Inside the ship, every note, every movement, every response by the juvenile serpents to the music lesson is carefully monitored and recorded. The ingenious engineering design of the boat is based upon the key controlling elements of the original cradle. However, although segments of gold metallic material, as well as the long black rods and even portions of the fat fish with legs, appear in the computer that runs the ship, the primary constituents of its mass are derived from great quantities of local rock and organic matter taken from the floor of the Emerald Lake. The ship is the quintessential music teacher, a virtually perfect synthesizer equipped with microprocessors that not only store all the responses of the pupils, but also contain software that will allow experimentation with a range of individualized methods of teaching. But this sophisticated robot, engineered by the artificial intelligence packed around the serpent zygotes and made almost entirely of chemical compounds extracted from material found in the neighborhood of the landing point, is itself being watched and studied from afar by test engineers. The current test is in its earliest stages and is progressing splendidly. This is the third different configuration tried for the music teacher, the hardest part of the design of the cradle that will carry the serpent zygotes back to Canther. The first was an abysmal failure. The embryos developed into adolescence all right, but the teacher was never able to instruct them well enough that they could sing the mating song and reproduce. The second design was better. It was able to teach the serpents to perform the courtship symphony, and a new generation of the species was produced. However, this next group of adult serpents was not able subsequently to teach their progeny to sing. The best of the bioengineering personnel in the colony were brought in to study this problem. After poring over quadrillions of bits of accumulated data associated with the development of the serpents and other related species, they found a curious correlation between the degree of nurturing provided by the parent and the resulting ability of that infant, upon reaching maturity, to teach its own offspring. the artificial intelligence package responsible for the first 6 months of serpent life was then redesigned to include a surrogate mother whose only purpose was to hold and cuddle the fledgling serpents at regular intervals. Subsystem tests proved successful. This slight alteration of the early nurturing protocol produced adult serpents that were able to teach their children to sing. This demonstration test lasts for more than 4 millicycles. At the end of the period, the test is declared an unqualified success. A strong, creative serpent population nearing 25,000 fills the artificial lake. Limitations to future growth are only test-related. Eventually, the test survivors are transported to another locale in the zoo complex, and the Canthorian serpents are added to the list of species ready for zygote repatriation. Saturday. 1. The full moon rises over the placid ocean. Troy stares at the moonbeams, watching them shimmer on the quiet water. Angie appears and stands in the water in front of him. She is wearing a skin-tight white bathing suit, one piece, and is submerged from the waist down. She beckons to him, and he walks across the damp sand toward the water. He is barefoot and is also wearing a white bathing suit. The water is surprisingly warm. Angie begins to sing. Her magnificent voice enfolds him as Troy draws nearer to her in the light surf. They touch and kiss. She pulls away and gives him a smile of encouragement. Troy feels himself becoming aroused. Suddenly, a siren pierces the air, destroying the calm of the night. Instantly, the sea becomes choppy, agitated, full of whitecaps. Troy turns around, alarmed, and glances at the shore. He sees nothing special. He looks back at the ocean. Angie has disappeared. Out in the distance, near the horizon, Troy thinks he sees the beginning of a tidal wave. The siren shrieks again, and Troy sees a large, shapeless mass riding a nearby wave in the moonlight. He goes toward the object. The tidal wave is now defined in the distance, filling half his dream screen. The bulky object nearby is a black body dressed in a red muscle shirt and blue jeans. The siren grows louder. Troy rolls the body over and looks at the face. It is his brother, Jamie. Troy Jefferson bolted upright in bed, his heart pounding furiously, his mind making the transition from the dream world to reality. Outside his duplex apartment, a siren raged. He could tell from the frequency change that the police car or ambulance had just sped past his front door. He shook himself and crawled out of bed. The digital clock on the end table read 3:03. Troy walked to the kitchen. He went to the refrigerator and poured himself a glass of grapefruit juice. He listened to the siren in the distance until it faded away altogether. Then he started back to the small second bedroom where he slept. In the hallway, he was stopped by the sound of another siren, this one even louder, that seemed to be coming toward him. For a few seconds, he thought the siren was just outside his front door, and he recalled vividly another siren in the middle of another night. His heart began to pound anew. "Jamie," Troy said to himself almost involuntarily. "Jamie, why did you have to die?" Troy could still see the events of that evening with perfect clarity. Nothing in the first tableau had faded even a little. The beginning memory was the three of them, Jamie, Troy, and their mother, sitting silently at the dinner table, eating fried chicken and mashed potatoes. Jamie had just arrived home from Gainesville for spring break that afternoon and had spent almost an hour, before they had sat down to eat, regaling his 15-year-old brother with stories of football and university life. Jamie had been Troy's idol throughout his childhood. Handsome, intelligent, and articulate, Jamie had also been blessed with incredible physical gifts. As a result, he had been the starting halfback for the Florida Gators in his sophomore year and was being touted as a potential All-American for the following season. Troy had bitterly missed Jamie when he had first gone away to the university, but in the intervening 18 months, he had learned to accept his absence and to look forward to his brother's holiday visits. "So, bro," Jamie had said with a smile when he finished his dinner and pushed his plate away. "What about you? You've finished another quarter already.
Did you make the grades of a future astronaut?
I did okay, Troy had replied, hiding his pride. I made a B+ in social studies because my teacher thought I had taken an anti-American position in my paper on the Panama Canal.
I guess an occasional B+ is acceptable, Jamie had laughed, his affection for his younger brother clearly showing.
But I bet Burford didn't make many B's when he was in the ninth grade.
Whenever Troy recalled the fateful evening that his brother was killed, he always remembered the mention of Guyon Burford, the first American black astronaut. Most of the time, his memory, because it was so painful to proceed immediately to the terrible recollection of his dying brother in his arms, would choose to digress to a happier time, to a remembrance of his brother Jamie that was almost as vivid as the death scene, but was happy and reinforcing instead of being gut-wrenching and depressing. During the summer before his death, on a hot, humid day in late August, Jamie Jefferson had arranged a third personal meeting with his football coach at Florida to request permission to skip practice for 2 days. He wanted to take his little brother, Troy, to see the launch of the space shuttle. In the first two meetings, the coach had vigorously opposed Jamie's taking the time away from the important workouts, but he had stopped short of denying the request.
"You still don't understand, Coach," Jamie had said firmly at the start of their third and final meeting on the subject. "My little brother has no father, and he's a genius at math and science. He blows the top off those standardized aptitude tests. He needs a role model. He needs to know that blacks can do something significant other than sports." The coach had eventually relented and given Jamie permission, but only because he had figured out that Jamie was going to go under any circumstances. Jamie had driven his battered Chevrolet nonstop across Florida, picked up his brother in Miami, and continued northward without sleeping for another 4 hours to Cocoa Beach. They had arrived in the middle of the night. Jamie, by now exhausted, parked the car in a beach access zone next to a 7-story condominium along the nicest part of the beach. "All right, little brother," he had said. "Now get some sleep." But Troy had not been able to sleep. He had been too excited thinking about the launch scheduled the next evening, the 8th shuttle launch and all, the first one that had ever occurred at night. He had been reading everything he could find about astronaut Burford and the plans for the mission. He kept imagining that it was the future and that he, Troy Jefferson, was an astronaut about to be launched into space. After all, Burford was living proof that it could indeed be done, that a black American could attain the upper echelons of society and become a popular hero on the basis of his intelligence, personality, and hard work. At sunrise, Troy had crawled out of the car and walked the few yards to the beach. It was very quiet. Troy's company was limited to a few walkers and joggers, plus a couple of those bizarre sand crabs whose eyes wavered back and forth at the end of peculiar stalks as they raced sideways into their holes in the sand. To the north, Troy could see some of the launch pads for the unmanned rockets at Cape Canaveral Air Force Base. But in his mind's eye, he saw them as the launching apparatus for the shuttle. He wondered what astronaut Burford was doing at that very moment. What was he eating for breakfast? Was he with his family or with the astronaut crew? Jamie had awakened around noon, and the brothers had spent the early afternoon on the beach together, laughing and playing in the surf. Then they picked up some hamburgers and drove the final half hour to the Kennedy Space Center. Jamie had strong-armed an avid gator booster, an aerospace executive who lived in Melbourne, for tickets to the VIP viewing area. They arrived there just before nightfall. 4 miles away, the impressive shuttle launch configuration, consisting of the orbiter mounted on top of an orange external tank with 2 solid rocket boosters on the side, stood erect against its launching tower as the final countdown began. No observing experience in Troy's life would ever come close to rivaling his watching the space shuttle blast off that night. As he listened to the countdown being announced over the loudspeakers in the VIP area, he was eager and anticipant, but not yet in awe. The moment the engines ignited, however, filling the Florida night with reddish-orange flame and thick white clouds of billowing smoke, Troy's eyes nearly popped out of his head.
but it was the combination of his seeing the giant spaceship slowly and majestically lifting itself into the heavens, riding a long, slender flame, and his hearing the astonishing sound, a constant roar punctuated with unexplained pops, which at only 4 miles away still arrived 20 or so seconds behind the side of the engine ignition, that really caused the goosebumps to break out on his skin, the tears to come to his eyes, and the tingle to spread through his body. Troy's intense emotional excitement lasted well over a minute. He stood beside his brother Jamie, tightly holding his hand, his back arched, as he strained to follow the flame rising higher and higher, and then finally disappearing in the night sky above him. After the launch, they slept again in the car. Jamie then dropped Troy at the bus station in Orlando and headed back to Gainesville for football practice. Young Troy felt that he was a new person, that he had been transformed by his experience. In the week that followed, he obsessively followed the flight. Burford became his hero, his new idol. During the first 2 quarters of the following year, he applied himself avidly to his schoolwork. He had a goal. He was going to be an astronaut. Little did Troy know that on a March night, only 7 months later, he would have another experience. This one devastating and deeply disturbing, that would completely overshadow the thrill he had felt at the shuttle launch. On that later March evening, his brother Jamie would stop by his room before leaving the house around 8 o'clock. "I'm going over to Maria's, bro," Jamie would say. "We'll probably take in a movie." Maria Alvarez was 18 and still a senior in high school. She had been Jamie's steady girl for a couple of years. She lived in Little Havana together with her Cuban family and 8 siblings. Troy had given his brother a hug. "I'm glad you're here, Jamie. There are so many things that I want to show you. I made you a set of headphones in school." "I want to see everything," his brother had interrupted him. "But tomorrow, first thing in the morning. Now, don't stay up too late. Astronauts need plenty of sleep so they can be alert." Jamie had smiled and walked out of Troy's room. It was the last thing Troy would ever hear him say. Troy never could remember what he had heard first when he had awakened in the middle of that night. His mother's wild wail had mixed with the screech of the nearby sirens to create an imbroglio of sound that was unforgettable and terrifying. Troy had raced to the door and into the front yard wearing only his pajama bottoms. The sound of the ambulance siren was drawing closer. His mother was at the end of the short walkway in front of the house, bending down over a dark body spread partly in the street in front of Jamie's Chevrolet and partly in their yard. 3 policemen and 6 curious bystanders were huddled around his distraught mother. "Somehow," he heard one of the policemen say as Troy, in a panic, tried to figure out what was happening, "he managed to drive home. It's incredible after all the blood he lost. He must have been hit 4 times in the stomach." His mother's cry intensified again, and, at that moment, Troy put all the pieces together and recognized the body lying on its back. A chill went through him. He gasped, and then Troy fell on his knees beside his brother's head. Jamie was struggling for breath. His eyes were open, but they did not seem to be focusing on anything. Troy cradled Jamie's head in his hands. He looked down at his brother's stomach. His red shirt was awash in blood that seemed to be flowing in a continuous stream from an area just above the genitals. Blood was on Jamie's jeans, on the ground, everywhere. Troy felt himself gag, then retch involuntarily. Nothing came up. Hot tears filled his eyes. "We think it was a gang shooting, Mrs. Jefferson," the policeman droned on. "Probably some kind of a mistake. Everybody knows that Jamie wasn't mixed up with that kind of crowd." Reporters had arrived. Lights were flashing from cameras. More sirens approached. Jamie's eyes went blank. There was no sign of breathing. Troy pulled his brother's head to his chest. He instinctively knew that Jamie was dead. He began to sob uncontrollably. "No," he mumbled. "No, not my brother. Not Jamie. He never hurt anybody." Someone tried to comfort him, to pat him on the shoulder. Troy shrugged them off violently. "Leave me alone," he shouted between sobs. "He was my brother. He was my only brother." After a couple of moments,
Troy tenderly placed Jamie's head back down on the ground. He then collapsed in total despair beside him. At almost 3:30 in the morning, some 10 years later, in March of 1994, Troy Jefferson would be at home, alone in his duplex, awake with the memory of that terrible moment when Jamie had died. He would feel anew the heartbreak of that loss, and he would realize again, very clearly, that most of his adolescent dreams had died with his brother, that he had forsaken his dreams of college and being an astronaut, because they were inextricably coupled with his memory of Jamie. Somehow, he had stumbled through high school in the 3 years that had followed Jamie's death, but it had taken the combined efforts of his mother and the school and the city authorities to keep Troy from abandoning school altogether. Then, as soon as he had graduated, he had left Miami, or rather, ran away. Away from what had happened and what might have been. For over 2 years, he then wandered in a desultory manner throughout North America, a young, solitary black man, bereft of love and friendship, looking for something to overcome the feeling of emptiness that was his constant companion. "So I finally came to Key West," Troy would think, years later, as he settled back in his bed in the middle of the morning for a couple more hours of sleep. "And for some reason made myself a home. Maybe it was just time, or maybe I had learned enough to know that life goes on. But somehow, although the wound has never healed, I got past Jamie and found the lost Troy. Or so I hope." The dream that had been interrupted by the siren suddenly came back into his mind. Angie was beautiful in the moonlight in her white bathing suit. "And now for some unfinished business," Troy laughed to himself, concentrating on the image of Angie as he returned to sleep. 2. "Good morning, Angel," Troy said with a grand smile as Carol approached the Florida Queen. "Ready to do some fishing?" He hopped out of the boat and shouted at Nick, who was around at the back on the other side of the canopy. "She's here, Professor," he hollered. "I'm going out to the parking lot to get her stuff." Carol gave Troy the keys to her car, and he took off in the direction of the marina office. Carol paced for a few moments on the jetty before Nick emerged from behind the canopy. "Come on down on the boat," he said, scowling a little as he wiped some heavy dredging chain with a dark cloth. Nick felt terrible. He had a nasty hangover, and he was still bothered by the events of the night before. Carol didn't say anything at first. Nick stopped cleaning the chain and waited for her to speak. "I don't know exactly how to say this," she began in a firm but pleasant voice, "but it's important to me that I say it before I get on the boat." Carol cleared her throat. "Nick," she said deliberately, "I don't want to dive with you today. I want to dive with Troy." Nick gave her a quizzical look. He was standing in the sun, and his head was aching. "But Troy," he began. "I know what you're going to say," she interrupted him. "He doesn't have much experience, and it could be a dangerous dive." She stared directly at Nick. "That doesn't matter to me. I have enough diving experience for both of us. I prefer to dive with Troy." She waited a few seconds. "Now, if you're not willing..." This time it was Nick who interrupted Carol. "All right, all right," he said, turning away. He was surprised to find that he was both hurt and angry. "This woman is still pissed," he said to himself, "and I thought maybe..." Nick walked away from Carol and went back on the other side of the canopy to finish preparing the small rented salvage crane he and Troy had installed the night before. Since they had used this old equipment several times on other excursions, the installation had been straightforward and without major problems. Carol climbed onto the boat and put her copy of the photos on top of the counter next to the steering wheel. "Where's the Trident?" she called to Nick. "I thought I'd take another look at it this morning." "Bottom left drawer under the nav equipment," was his swift and sharp reply. She took the gray bag out of the drawer, opened it, and pulled out the golden trident. She held it by the long middle rod. It felt funny for some reason. Carol put the object back in the bag and pulled it out a second time. Again, she held the heavy trident in her hands. It still didn't feel right. Carol remembered grasping the rod underneath the overhang in the water and wrapping her hand slowly around the central rod. "That's it," she said to herself. "It's thicker." She turned the object over in her hands. "What's the matter with me?" she thought. "Have I lost my mind? How could it be thicker?" She examined it one more time with great care. This time she thought that the individual tines of the fork had lengthened and that she could detect a perceptible increase in the overall weight. Good grief! Can this be possible? She wondered. Carol pulled out the photos she had brought along. All the images of the trident that she had with her had been taken underwater, but she was certain that she could discern two subtle changes since it was first photographed. The axis rod did appear to be thicker, and the tines of the fork did indeed look longer. "Nick," she said in a loud voice. "Nick, can you come here?" "I'm right in the middle of something," an unfriendly voice responded from the other side of the canopy. "Is it important?"
"No. I mean, yes," Carol answered. "But it can wait until your first available moment."
Carol's mind was racing. "There are only two possibilities," she said to herself with logical precision. "Either it has changed or it hasn't. If it hasn't changed, then I must be spooked. For it definitely seems thicker. But how could it change? Either on its own or someone changed it. But who? Nick? But how could he?" Nick came up to her. "Yes," he said in a distant, almost hostile tone. He was obviously annoyed. Carol handed him the trident.
"Well," she said, smiling and looking at him expectantly.
"Well, what?" he answered, totally confused by what was happening and still angry about the earlier interaction.
"Can you tell the difference?" Carol continued, nodding at the trident in his hand.
Nick turned it upside down as she had done. The sunlight glinted off the golden surface and hurt his eyes. He squinted. Then he switched the object from hand to hand and looked at it from many different angles.
"I think I'm lost," Nick said at length. "Are you trying to tell me there's some change in this thing?"
He held it out between them.
"Yes," she said. "Can't you feel it? The central rod's thicker than it was on Thursday, and the tines or individual elements of that fork on one end are a little longer. And don't you think the whole thing is heavier?"
Nick's headache continued to throb. He looked back and forth between the trident and Carol. As far as he could tell, the object had not changed.
"No, I don't," he said. "It seems the same to me."
"You're just being difficult," Carol persisted, grabbing the trident back. "Here, look at the pictures. Check out the length of the fork there compared to the overall rod, and then look at it now. It's different."
There was something in Carol's general attitude that really irritated Nick. She always seemed to assume that she was right and everyone else was wrong.
"This is absurd," Nick nearly shouted in reply, "and I have a lot of work to do."
He paused for a moment and then continued. "How the hell could it change? It's a metal object, for Christ's sake. What do you think, that somehow it grew? Shit." He shook his head and started to walk away. After a couple of steps, he turned around.
"You can't trust the pictures anyway," he said in more measured tones. "Underwater photos always distort the objects."
Troy was approaching with both the cart and Carol's equipment. He could tell from the body positions, even without hearing the words, that his two boatmates were at it again.
"My, my," he said as he walked up. "I can't leave you two alone for a minute. What are you fighting about this morning, Professor?"
"This supposedly intelligent reporter friend of yours," Nick replied, looking at Carol and speaking in a patronizing manner, "insists that our trident has changed shape. Overnight, I guess. Although she has not yet begun to explain how. Will you please, since she won't believe me, explain to her about the index of refraction or whatever it is that fouls up underwater pictures?"
Carol appealed to Troy. But it has changed, honest. I remember clearly what it felt like at first, and now it feels different.
Troy was unloading the cart and putting the ocean telescope system on the Florida Queen.
Angel, Troy said, stopping to check the trident that she was extending toward him with both hands. I can't tell whether it has changed or not, but I can tell you one thing. You were very excited when you found it the first time, and you were also underwater. With that combination, I wouldn't trust my own memory of how something felt.
Carol looked at the two men. She was going to pursue the discussion, but Nick abruptly changed the subject.
Did you know, Mr. Jefferson, that our client, Miss Dawson, has requested your services as a diving partner today? She doesn't want to dive with me.
His tone was now acerbic.